front desk.
Good morning and welcome to episode 76 of the Kraken Backs podcast with your hosts, Dr. Terry Wyman and Dr. Spencer Barron. How are you doing this morning, guys?
Doing great, Lance.
Good to see you, Lance.
That's great to hear. So today we are joined by Dr. Andy Klein. Dr. Andy Klein received a BA in physical education from Lehman College in 1981 and an MS education in exercise physiology from Queens College in 1983. He served as the team chiropractor for the Minnesota Vikings from 2002 to 2006, and he practiced for 21 years in the physical medicine and rehabilitation department at Park Nicolet Clinic. He is currently the director at the Human Performance Center at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Minnesota. How are you doing this morning, Dr. Andy?
Oh, terrific. Terrific. I appreciate that. Oh, by the way, you know, I don't ever go by Dr. Andy. I don't even let my patients call me Dr. Andy. It's one of those things. They can call me Dr. Klein or they can call me Andy. I'm fine with them that. But there's something about Dr. Andy, you know, from my generation, it's almost like Captain Jack. I always prefer just Andy, you know?
So on that note, Dr. Andy.
I thought it was going to be Spencer who said that, not you. I thought he'd beat you to it.
No, no.
I was being nice for a moment.
When have you been nice for a moment? Like a moment.
Right now. There but that's go. It.
Man, it's good to see you, buddy. You know, it's been way too long for me. I know Spencer's probably seen you sooner than I have, but man, it's been way too long.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was happy to come by. I figured at the very least I get to see you on video, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, that's a problem when I thank God for technology, because, you know, to have this, you know, an East Coast and a West Coast doctor putting on a podcast, you know, this is the only way we could do it if we didn't have it flying back and forth to a studio. So it's just, but thank God for technology. So it's great to see you, man.
Oh, you too. You too. Happy to be here this morning, afternoon.
I want to kick this off because we were always looking for hooks or something unique that they can grab the audience in. So, Dr. Andy, the odds of an athlete. So Dr. Spencer looked up some stuff, and the odds of an athlete qualifying for the Olympic Games is approximately like 13,000% I mean, it's like so low. It's not even ridiculous. And a small percentage of doctors actually ever make it to the Olympic Games to treat these athletes. Yet you went to Australia in the Olympic Games of 2000 after only being out of school for 3 freaking years. I mean, how did you?
Whoa, not 3 years. I was out for 13.
13 years.
I graduated Northwestern, New York, which is now Northeast. I graduated in 87.
Okay. So I read some stats wrong that I was like going, what? How did you pull this off? Because, you know, I was looking at, you know, stuff like you graduated in, you know, 87 and then 88. You're at the Goodwill Games. Is that true? Did you go to the Goodwill Games?
No, the Goodwill Games was 98.
I'll say it.
So the dates are just a little mixed up.
So I got that from a bio somewhere, though. So there's some dates that were wrong. You know, I cut
yeah, those dates were wrong. So I graduated Northeast New York at the time in 87. And then, so the Goodwill Games was in 98. So I did my internship at Colorado Springs in 97. So I was out 10 years before.
All right, then forget this podcast, because now you're just like another joke.
Yeah. Well, I apologize for that.
Yeah. All right, Spencer, I got nothing left. You know, I thought he was really special, and I knew, you know, because the only other stuff I had on him was doing YouTube videos running up and down what he calls a hill. You know, and I'm like, a hill? I live it. We have mountains. You know, that's like my driveway. Yes. And so I'm like, you know, Mr. Exercise Guru here, running up and down the hill, swinging this kettlebell and I'm trying to be an influencer, I go, well, that's, you know, that's kind of fun, but I really want to know how the hell they made it to the Olympics.
I'm still not quite sure. I think it's a lot of the times it's luck. It's being in the right spot at the right time. You know, when I went to the Olympics, so at that time, they only brought one chiropractor at a time. And it looked like, because you can kind of get a sense of where you are on the totem pole. And it was me and Sokolov, Alan Sokolov, were kind of like neck and neck. And we did the Goodwill Games together in 98. And so there were two spots. I was stationed in Manhattan. He was stationed on Long Island. So the guy who ended up being the chef de mission for Sydney was Brock Schnabel, who I was with. And I think, you know, I mean, how do you decide between two people? I think the things that really put me over the top, there were two things. One is an athlete got hurt in the city and he had to go to Lenox Hill Hospital and everybody was afraid to drive in New York. And I was from New York. So I said, hey, I'll drive him over to Lenox Hill. So I think that was big. someone who wasn't afraid to drive the streets of New York. I think that helped. And then, you know, that was 98. So I'd moved to Minnesota in 95. So, I mean, I still had family in New York, and one of my brothers, and he was working in New York at the time. He's now retired, but he was a federal agent. Him and one of my sons, who was like 9 at the time, they went to my favorite pizzeria in the Bronx, Sorrento's. And I said, you know what? And they brought 10 Sicilian pies down to the hotel where I was with the staff. So I think it wasn't any kind of specific skill as much as pizza and driving that got me to the Olympics.
Yeah, they always say how powerful networking is, and you just proved it right there.
Yes. Oh, wow. My brother pulled up. Yeah, you know, great. He had his federal license. He didn't have to worry about parking. He walked right in. You know, we had New York police, and they saw his badge and everything. Oh, yeah, go right up. No problem. And especially with the pizza. We gave some of the cops some of the pizza, too.
So, you know, Andy, I got to tell you, man, you sell yourself short. You have become one of the brightest speakers that I've listened to all across the country. I'm not just blowing smoke. I really mean it, Andy. I love listening to you. I mean, we even lectured together back in Hawaii when it was the ACA Sports Council.
First time we met.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I will tell you, Terry, when lecturing with Andy, you better have your proverbial shit together because he was absolutely stellar, even back then. Andy, there is something that I want to ask you for the average listener out there that's maybe a non-athlete or not a doctor. You presented a remarkable image of an athlete that had the worst biomechanics and they were an Olympic athlete. I hope you remember this. Even if you don't, it really boils down to the core of something that you like to quote Professor Lewitt about. You know, don't try to teach perfect movement patterns, rather correct the key fault that is causing the trouble. So many practitioners, whether they call themselves sports docs or not, they all try to fix certain things. Could you share us what you feel about that statement?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of that comes from, you know, physical education, all those courses I took in exercise physiology and motor learning. And that kind of, you know, we talk about, okay, what is the proper motor pattern? There is no one specific proper motor pattern. In fact, every person has like 3 or 4 motor patterns. They have one that they rely on. They have one that they can use when they get fatigued. It's almost like, how do you throw a football? All right. Mm-hmm. And now tell Mahomes to throw a football as a 300-pound lineman is crashing down on him and he's throwing underhand or he's throwing sidearm. And it's right there. So we have these different motor patterns. You know, at Northwestern and a lot of places, I think the key thing is figure out what the normal asymmetry is and leave it alone. I mean, people have normal asymmetries. In fact, there are certain asymmetries you'd expect to see in sports. So why are we trying to correct things that are basically normal? Look for the pathological asymmetry. I think that's more what we have to do. I mean, I think if I looked at every person, I could find something wrong with every person according to the textbooks, but that's just not who we are or how we develop. So I would tell people, you know, the runner you were talking about was a female. I can't remember her name now. She was a marathon runner. And every back step she took, her right leg just flew out to the side. And I mean, I guess she could correct it. And then she'd be like 10 minutes slower and she wouldn't be a champion. but you know, I don't. She'd look better. I don't know. I think she looks better with the leg flying out and the metal around her neck.
Wow.
So with that said, Andy, so what do you look for when you're trying to correct or trying to resolve an injury or remove the potential for an injury?
Well, you know, that's one thing is when they come in with an injury, they have specific symptoms that you're looking at. You know, I think, you know, I hate to use the word functional. I think functional is almost a marketing term that we start using to try and separate ourselves, because functional means that, okay, it has a purpose. Is there anyone really out there doing something that doesn't have a purpose? I mean, isn't everything we do kind of functional? Isn't that the whole concept there?
Right.
So it's almost like orthopedic testing is designed to reproduce pain and symptoms. I don't worry that much about orthopedic testing. I may use a couple here and there to differentiate, but they already have pain on movement. I want to see what can I do to relieve that pain. What movement helps if I'm relieving that pain? I just talked about this in a case study. I had a pro golfer, and on the takeaway, he had back pain. And so we did some mock swings. And what I found out is when I pushed into like that L4, L5 low back area on the left, when I pushed in, as he went back, the pain went away. So I go, okay, now I've got rid of the pain. Now what do I do? What does that mean? Well, the simple thing to do is to say, well, it's a right rotation restriction. And when I press on that left side, I kind of move the vertebra to the right rotation, he's better. But that's really, I don't really know what I'm doing when I do that. For all I know, it wasn't rotation at all. Maybe it was translation that helped. Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe I had no effect on the vertebra and it was the connective tissue of pressing into the muscle and connective tissue. The only thing I know for sure is that when I pressed into the left side, he felt better. That's all mm-hmm. I know. Now, I may document that as a right rotation restriction, but in my mind, I know like if I adjust in that area, he may get better. I still don't know what I did. All I know is I applied pressure in an area. But if you have to pin me down to what I exactly did physiologically, I wouldn't know. You know, I don't have ultrasound going, you know, while I'm moving him to see exactly what's moving, what pressure is going on.
So, but Andy, when would you understand, when would you use the term functional? Because you are putting the patient in a situation that is functional to their sport or their activity or, yeah. or that removes the pain.
Right. I would say it's being more sports or task specific than I would say functional. You know, I think okay. that might be
like
a better
that.
Term.
Yeah.
Something more specific. Yeah. So generally when the athlete comes in, a lot of times what I do is, you know, I'm looking at them. And then once I have them going, you know, almost like a reconstruction, I use a lot of myofascial stuff. You know, I follow Thomas Myers' myofascial lines. I'm a member of the if you're not a member of the Fascia Research Society, become one. I mean, the information you get, those men and women are doing such incredible work. So I follow a lot of that. You know, the more and more we find out about fascia, it's just fascinating, the nerve receptors and what's going on there. And, you know, the evolution, and you guys have gone through it too. We don't practice the same way we practiced when we got out. You know, you just continue, you make mistakes, you learn. And now when I'm looking at fascia, you know, at one point I did a lot of myofascial work and said, oh, we're breaking up adhesions, which was really good. That lasted a while till we found out there really aren't any adhesions there, you know, unless it's post-surgical, you know. Mm-hmm. And now it's kind of the concept is densification. So now what am I doing? Like, I don't know if you've heard that term, well, densification.
No, what is that? What is that?
Densification is the connective tissue. It's almost that's what seems to be restricting some of the fascial movement. A lot of
what
that comes
at the cellular level.
We're not sure at the cellular level. I mean, they're still working on that. Stecco is doing a ton of work on densification. And then you have some of the other people talking about, you know, listening to Robert Schleip and people like that. So I have a resident here who is who does ultrasound, MSK ultrasound. So we've been playing with it where he does the ultrasound while I'm doing the muscle work to see, okay, what's the effect? And we've been playing with some of that stuff. We have some more work to go. Unfortunately, he's going down to the World game, so I'm going to lose him for a couple of weeks. But just looking at that kind of stuff to see what are we doing? What kind of an effect? You know, like looking at the bicep. And if I do work, so he'll what we're going to start doing is he'll be looking at the bicep muscle, And then I'm going to work on the forearm flexors to see if there's any change at the bicep as I'm working on the forearm flexors. If I started going to extension, things like that, to see if we can get some idea of exactly what's going on. But right now, if you ask me, like, with myofascial work, what am I doing? What's the reason for it? I'm not even sure. Like, I can show you five articles on rolling that say it doesn't do anything, and I can show you five articles on rolling that say it does help. And I think a lot of the myofascial work, it's basically making the tissue more pliable. And once it's pliable, you have them exercise right away, develop some good motor patterns, and hopefully it sticks. But, you know, they're talking about with a lot of the soft tissue we do, we're actually changing the volume in the matrix, you know, the amount of water. We're forcing that out. That's going to come back in. So does that come back in with more nutrients? Who knows? I mean, we know that the athletes feel great.
Yeah,
but we're not sure why.
Let me have you back up a minute. Sure. I want to understand a little more deeply what densification is. Is it maybe not on a cellular level, but what happens to the muscle? What are you feeling for?
When we say, okay, I feel tightness there, or I feel hypertonicity or something like that, I think what we might be feeling is the densification of the tissue, where it's just bound up, and I'm not sure if it's maybe more fluid in there that's creating that densification, so it feels stiffer. And then if you work it out, work that fluid out, then they feel like they have more elasticity, they feel more pliable. But I don't think we're still sure what it is.
Is that what we call trigger points? Or
it could be
myofascial pain syndromes, or
it could be. I mean, I've heard so many things, you know, still trying to, you know, we're talking about trigger points. What's the evidence behind trigger points? Is it where there's a greater density of nerves in specific areas of the muscle? I mean, this is all up in the air. You know, we talk about it a lot of times, like, oh yeah, this is well known, this is well documented, but we don't.
You know, you want.
And when you said, oh, sorry, I was just going to ask, when you said rolling, I don't think
like foam rolling.
Foam rolling. Okay.
Yeah, foam rolling. Yeah.
All right.
You went back and you were saying when you pushed on that lower lumbar, and you know you made him feel better, but you really didn't know what you were doing, right? Or what?
Yeah.
So how do you get to where you know what you're doing? What's that next step?
Oh, I haven't gotten there yet. When I get to the step where I know, I'll let you know also.
So the guy walks out. Yeah, you pushed on me. Felt great. And what do you do next? I have no idea.
So what I did is I did do an adjustment in the lumbar region in that area. I got a release fine, but he felt better. But if you ask me, okay, what did the adjustment actually do? I can't tell you. I can't tell you if the effect, you know. I used to think that when we adjusted, it was local, you got the joint to move and everything like that. Now I'm looking at it more as a neurological phenomenon, where what you do is, like, when we adjust that vertebra, we put a stretch on the capsule, which has a local effect. But we also know there's a central nervous system effect. When you do a manipulation, we can see changes in the cortical. We see changes in the descending cortical spinal tract. So now I'm thinking, you know, when they say, well, you know how many, we've seen some studies where, well, you say you adjusted this, but that the force went somewhere else and you can't be sure where the force goes. Maybe the force being specific isn't as important, like a specific segment as opposed to a specific region. Like whether you did a L4 or L5, does it matter? Or was it just that you did low lumbars? We may find that ends up being the case.
You know, I found it very interesting when Power Plate came out. You guys know Power Plate, the big vibration machine.
Yes.
And they came out and I would use them at Miami Dolphins, and you know, your joints feel fresh and you feel like you can, you know, sprint somewhere. And I started relating the concept that, you know what, it's mobilizing the joints at a frequency, but the same thing happens when we adjust spine or extremities. Patients have pain management. And what also allowed understanding neurology is that drive up the dorsal columns into the cerebellum. You don't have just localized pain control or pain management, but you get this endorphin release that allows the body to feel painlessness. So it's kind of neat that, you know, what we do is so powerful. It's, you know, the idea of manipulation, not just of spine and extremities, but the tissues.
Yeah.
So that's obviously what you're embarking on at a higher level.
Yeah, but it's just the further we go, the less we know. You know, it's like you end up with more questions than answers. The vibration, I've been looking at vibration for the last couple of years. I find it fascinating. So once again, you know, so you look at the research on vibration, and I can show you the articles where it doesn't help. I can show you the articles where it does help. And then you got to go to the methodology. Is there a common bond in the papers that say it doesn't help? Is there a common bond in the papers that say it does help? And then you got to even go to the plate. What kind of plate did they use? Did they use uniaxial vibration? Did they use triaxial vibration? I think, you know, from what I can read, if you're in that 30 to 36 hertz range, you're going to get some benefit. You're going to get some nice stimulation into the neurological system. We played with it, and this was like, you know, one of the things is, you know, sometimes athletes will do things that you might not do with other patients. So this is a recreational hockey player I had, a goalie in her 50s, who had bilateral neuropathy as a side effect of chemotherapy. And, you know, bilateral, I mean, that's something that doesn't go away. That could let, and, you know, she was getting a combination, you know, in our clinic here, a combination of acupuncture and chiropractic. And we said, let's try this. So we had her do some work on the vibration plate. And then we finished her off with Normatec, and she started getting sensation back. And, you know, this is in conjunction. Her medical doctor knows this also. I don't know even what we did. I just didn't feel like there was a big, you know, side effect that there would be a big downside. And she wanted to try it, you know. And so she's been kind of happy with it. So we've gotten some success that way. I still don't know what exactly it's doing.
That's great, man. I love it. I love it. You know, that's the sign of a real researcher, man.
Totally.
Somebody goes,
or a crazy person.
yeah, the smart guys.
I think crazy people are sure that they know what they're doing. No.
That's true. That seems like
the crazy people are the ones who don't think they're crazy. Yeah. That's the problem.
that's because they're off their medication.
There you go. It seems like the smarter you are, the less you know, right?
Yeah, I think that's the definition of like of being smart is knowing how little you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, I you know, when the gyms were all closed during the last 2 years and a lot of people moved outside, you know, we know that people sat for an average of 2-3 hours more than they ever did before, looking at screens, looking at computers, you know, not knowing what to do. And then, you know, I saw you try to help people by running up what you call a hill. And doing your Jane Fonda workouts. And so, yeah, so for those who just who were shut down for 2 years, or they now are working from home, so they're not walking to their office, all that, what's the advice you're giving them that how to start running and moving again without getting injured from all the biomechanical shutdown?
You know, it's just getting back into it slowly, you know, and just getting out and walking and beginning that, you know, nothing that's changed. You know, a lot of these people were sedentary before COVID. They didn't all of a sudden all become sedentary because of COVID. A lot of these people were out of shape. I mean, wasn't that the elephant in the room with COVID? How many people were vulnerable because of that? What poor shape they were in? They were more vulnerable to begin with. You would hope this would wake people up, but there were all kind of changes. You know, I don't mind going outside. And, you know, in Minnesota, it gets very cold in the winter, but it's kind of the lifestyle. So there are a lot of Minnesotans who they have their snowshoes, they have their cross-country skis. They're going to be out there anyway. Or they're going to be ice fishing, although I'm not sure that counts as a winter sport if you're in like – I mean, there are some cabins out there like on the lake that are nicer than my house.
Yeah.
I mean, some people really go all out on these fishing cabins. So, but it was fun. I know one thing, you know, my daughter, who was a volleyball player, and she was climbing in the gyms, doing a lot of indoor climbing, and COVID hit, and she ended up, you know, her friend said, hey, let's go disc golf. You can do disc golf without worrying about it. And she fell in love with disc golf. So she ended up, you know, about a year ago, a year and a half ago, hey, Dad, I'm quitting my job. I'm becoming a professional disc golfer. I said, a what? What is that?
you know? I don't even know. What is disc golf?
You don't know what disc golf
is? Like a frisbee?
Don't say this in front of them, but it's a frisbee. It's like all these frisbees like that you throw, and you have a golf course, like 500, 600. She has some holes. I went to watch her play last week. She had a tournament in Minnesota, and one of the holes was like 900 feet. You know, it's a, like it was a par four, or par five. And they go out there. They have like they have these backpacks or carts with like 35 discs in them. They have their drivers. They have their mid-range. They have their putters. They have their drivers that fade to the left, that fade to the right. They have different weights depending on wind conditions. So, oh, yeah, yeah. My daughter and two friends moved to South Carolina last winter so they could practice more because Minnesota's cold. Now she bought a van. A friend of her fixed it up. My daughter lives in a van by the river, and she goes from tournament to tournament. You know, she's actually, in fact, I think she tees off today, my time, in about 10 minutes in Madison, Wisconsin, like one of the biggest women's tournaments in the country.
It's crazy. Do you know during the shutdown, the disc golf business almost went out of business because the supply chain from China, where most of them were made, got cut off, and you couldn't get the disc anymore. So, like, we have a huge area down here, and you couldn't buy discs. And then what they saw, what a driver would, or like a mid-range disc would cost $15, they're selling for $80 to $100 because the supply chain got so racked. And then it became a huge issue out here that people couldn't get these discs anymore. And all the stores were out of them. And, yeah, they got behind. And it was pretty – it was an interesting little phenomenon that happened as a result of it.
Yeah. What are you trying to do? How do you does the disc go into a net? Are you trying to shoot it into a hole?
At the hole,
what are you
doing? Instead of a hole, there's like a stanchion there with a cage, and there are chains that hang down. So you can throw it, and it should hit the chain right, and it just falls into the basket. All right. But there are some people, you know, if it doesn't hit just right, it can bounce off the chain, which is totally frustrating to the golfer. Sometimes they hit off the bottom of the basket. They don't get enough height. But I'm just fascinated. I see some of these throws these men and women make, and I am just I'm stupefied at how good they
are. There's a YouTube video that went viral of a guy off a tee, and he threw it, and I want to say it's 500 yards, and it went way up in the air, and it came down. It was a hole in one, and went right into the net, and it was unbelievable, and it had almost close to a million views. It was crazy.
I think that was actually filmed on because they were filming that. I think it was a championship match, and I think ESPN2 was filming it for later date, for later showing.
Yes, so you saw it too. It was incredible. Yeah. Incredible shot.
Oh, you know, and being on like some – because of my daughter, I'm following some on Instagram. Obviously, it went – the viral went – it was nuts how quickly it spread.
Yeah, it was huge. Yeah. It was not as good as your videos, but it was close.
You know, I got to tell you, Terry, when you were talking about Andy, you know, going up or down a hill, the moment you said swinging, and I go, he's not going to say swinging his balls. Is he? He's going to say swinging his kettlebells. I go, I got to see this video, man. This is out of control.
Oh, it's classic.
The video you're referring to, Spencer, that was done in the late 60s, early 70s. And I did have it removed from the internet.
You were naked, weren't you? I knew it.
Hey, it was the 60s.
Hey,
yes, of course. Anything goes.
Is there anything that's truly, truly pulled from the internet?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping I found the
like, Lance, I think you need to do a deep dive right now.
So, Andy, I'm going to ask you a couple questions. I'm going to take advantage of your intelligence and quick thinking and New York attitude. We're going to do about four questions, rapid fire. Each one gets 1 minute. Are you prepared for this?
No.
Okay. Well, that's the first question, and you failed that one already. Okay. So, all right. In one minute, give me your best abdominal exercise that anybody could do anywhere.
All right. That's such a loaded question. I would tell you like a heavy lift, like a deadlift carry or farmer's carry suitcase, something like that. That would be my favorite for core. I can only choose one. The amount of core stabilization you get from lifting and stuff like that, that would be my number one choice.
I did not expect that. Nice. In 1 minute, give me your best hip exercise to combat excessive sitting.
Excessive sitting? I would have them like do a kick where they kick the chair away and they can never sit in it again.
Oh, See, I told you. He should write comedy.
If I have to choose one, I think the hip airplane is kind of cool, doing hip airplanes, you know, where you're on one leg. Have you seen that exercise?
Show it.
McGill. I mean, I got it from McGill.
I'm afraid to say show me, but don't, because you probably don't have pants.
I'm not showing.
You probably don't have pants on. Anyway, so
I don't know. I do have the video. If you want, we could check. You know, I'm at that age where I thought I put pants on this morning, but you can never be sure.
There you go. All right. So the airplane, what'd you call it? Just describe
it. It's a hip airplane. You're basically on one leg and you lean over and your arms are out. And then you pivot on the one leg. So you're kind of externally rotating on your stance leg. And then you're internally rotating on the stance leg. And you can do that with support. You don't have to do it on support. You can do it supported. I just really like what it does for the glute muscle.
I love it. I love it. Best neck exercise?
Well, my favorite exercise is something really simple that I almost every one of my patients get where they're on their back and they do a simple bridge, just bring the hips up a little bit, but at the same time, they retract their chin down to their neck. And I'll have them work up. And, you know, just from some of the research I saw coming out of Finland and Denmark, that people with chronic neck pain, if they can get to the point of like 10 repetitions, holding each repetition for 10 seconds, goes a long way towards clearing up chronic neck pain.
Fantastic.
I do. I have been getting into the iron neck, though.
Have you really? Ooh,
yes. Oh, I finally figured out how to make it, because you really need something on your head so it doesn't move too much. So I've just been using a towel, and I've been playing with it because I've had some chronic neck pain since a motor vehicle accident in 2008. I was hit by a drunk driver, and I had some issues after that. And that has really been helping my mobility, not just my strength, but it's been helping my mobility.
Interesting. I know Joe Rogan's a big guy on that. He uses that quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, I was asked to do all the neck strengthening in 2013 for the Miami Dolphins. And, you know, the head of strength and conditioning, I collaborated on it, and they bought – you know how much an iron neck is. It's about $700 or $800.
It's come down in price a lot since then.
Has it?
Yeah.
Well, as you can imagine, Miami Dolphins bought 8 of them. So, you know, we had guys line up. And I got to tell you, it was really interesting because the compression around the head, they were – now you got like 50 guys doing neck strengthening and you get a variety of symptoms that come out of compression on the head or certain movements that – some of these guys wanted to vomit afterwards because they felt an imbalance or too much pressure on the head. So it was, I don't know if it's for everybody. There's other neck exercises out there, but.
Well, I mean, just in terms of neck, I mean, just doing shrugs, how good are shrugs and just for the neck and stuff like that. But one of the things I look at the iron neck is, and I don't know if this was the issue or not, because I know how competitive the NFL players are. You know, we had the arm machine in the Viking locker room and who could take the most pain, that type of thing. But the iron neck really is, if you really start off easy, you don't go to the maximum length on the band. You go to an easy length and you just build up. So I'm wondering if maybe they went maximum length or they attached it to the cable machine where they actually were lifting weight with it too, instead of just doing some of the basic elasticity exercises.
Did the one you have still have the bladder you pump up to form fit around your head?
No. I find it pretty comfortable, and they do have like different inserts you can put in, but I don't have the one where you pump up the bladder.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Which that might have been the problem too. A lot of compression on the skull. And the last question, Andy, best foot and ankle exercise.
Oh, best foot and ankle exercise. All right. I mean, once again, it depends on what you're dealing with. If you're dealing with like a tendinopathy, you're just going to do eccentric calf raises, you know, for the tendon. But if you're talking about strength and really moving and function, I love straight leg bounds. Some people call them ankling, where you're just pushing off the foot. It looks kind of weird where you do like a 10-meter or 20-meter sprint, basically just using the ankles. I mean, that's a great exercise. Yeah.
Very, very good. Well, thanks, Andy. That was actually very unexpected, the answers you provided, and that's what I love. it stretches our imagination.
I wasn't expecting half of those answers. That was pretty good. So would you, staying on the neck with the iron neck and the bridging, what's your advice for all these tech necks that's now this popular term?
Well, you know what? It's weird because, you know, I've seen some research papers that say tech neck doesn't exist, and then some that say it does. So if you go to no, there are a couple papers out there, but if you look at all the papers that say it doesn't exist, they're usually dealing with people like 17, 18, 19, in which case you can do anything. And they even did a recent meta-analysis that said even if with bad neck, like 5 years later, they still don't have tech neck. Well, that's because they're 22, 23. They're still not. But, I mean, everything that we see on forward head posture, it is related to neck pain when you get into your 30s and 40s, you know. And how many times have we seen patients who have neck pain? We just have them sit up straight and they feel better. So clearly there is something going on there. I'm wondering if maybe we had, you know, I just spoke to some students. I walked in and they were all staring at their phone. And I told them, you know what? 35 years ago, this wouldn't have happened. Instead, you'd all be staring down into your newspaper, your New York Times and stuff like that. And you'd have the same problem, but it would just be a newspaper. So I'm not sure how different it is. You know, in certain cases, we didn't keep track of it. Nobody called it newspaper neck, but I mean,
do you think they stare at their phone longer than they would the newspaper? They'll read the newspaper for a while and throw it away. But these people get hooked into their phones or videos or this for hours.
I don't know. It's hard to say. If they did it gradually, would they build up enough strength so it wouldn't occur? And if they're looking at their screen all the time, are they doing anything else? I mean, if they're lifting and doing a lot of great work, I mean, if they're doing like if they're CrossFitters who also happen to look at their phone a lot, I'm guessing they won't have much neck pain unless they hurt themselves doing CrossFit, of course. But otherwise, with their strength. So I wouldn't recommend staring down at your screen all the time, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure how big a problem it is. You know,
no once kidding. Again,
yeah.
Leave I mean, it, we'll, leave it to. Leave it to Andy to buck the system.
No, I mean, I'm looking at it, and I guess I don't see enough young patients either. And I don't think they're going to have issues. If they have issues, it's not going to occur till they're in their 30s. So we won't know, really.
Yeah. Mm. You know what we've noticed at our patients? I started looking at – so the iPhone, I don't know if the other phones do it, but the iPhone measures your screen time. And so – we start looking at patients. I have every patient now walk in and show me their screen time.
Wow.
And so what I've seen is the average screen time went up 3 hours.
Whoa.
And so some of these people are doing eight, believe it or not, the average I'm seeing, and it's not just kids, it's adults too. The average I'm seeing is 8 to 12 hours per day of screen time. So now you want to do some research. You have a 10 to 12 pound head and you have it in full flexion for 8 to 12 hours a day. If you, it's going to have an effect. Do we going to see it today? I don't know. We're going to see it tomorrow. So my whole thing is I'm trying to reduce screen time by 20%. And I go put alarms on and all that and reduce 20%. I have not yet seen anyone come into my office in the last 6 months that has less screen time than 4 hours.
Wow.
Actually, that's not true. Three and a half hours.
Do you think
per day?
So you see a lot of it, Terry. Do you think, for example, I see some people, I think they have more trouble if they look at a computer screen because they start leaning forward too much, especially as their eyes get tired. And what I found fascinating with some of the younger people is they're doing everything on their phone. I can't do that on my phone because I can't read it on my phone. You know, I need a larger screen, so I can't even use the phone for that long a time. You know.
Yes, but I'm seeing a lot of people our age, they're on their phones for 6 to 8 hours.
Wow.
And they just have the font big. So, you know, they're still on the computers a lot and they're working on ergonomics, setting things up. But
yeah,
when you start asking some of these people what they're, if they have an iPhone, pull up their screen time, you'd be kind of shocked.
Wow. I mean, just think of that. 8 hours on an iPhone when you could be at like a brewery. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Or running a hill in Minnesota.
Or swinging a kettlebell and running a hill. And if you notice, the pants I wear, I just realized that I have a number of like rain pants that are large. And someone told me it reminds them of MC Hammer because they look so large.
That's not who it reminded me of. It reminded me of grumpy old men. But yeah, okay. Well, I'll go with them.
I could go with that. Either one is like an upgrade for my normal lifestyle.
Oh my God. Can't touch this. Oh my gosh. So Andy, let me ask you, because we talk about, you know, forward posture or more of like an anterior translation to the head while we're on a computer or a desktop are you guys familiar with the chiropractic biophysics? It's all that, you know, they really deliver that message about cervical extension and doing, extension traction and all that. And I mean, some of the stuff they do, it's basically the opposite of everything we do with text neck. And so their whole purpose is to restore cervical curves using the same concept of, you know, spending time in extension. I mean, and it works. I mean, I've seen, you know, before and after x-rays and things like that.
A lot of that's Harrison's work. And yeah. I'm always a little skeptical of before and after x-rays. And I also, you know, I want to see the entire population that they work with. I don't want to see, you know, some people who got better. That's the thing with seminars. Doctors only tell you about the success stories, you know, and right. they don't tell you about all the failures. The best doctors I know, which I put you guys in that category, you can have 100 patients and get 99 of them better. And you're going to talk to me about the one who didn't get better. You know, the 1%, that's who you're going to talk to me about. You know, these seminars, I'm not sure if you get a 50-year-old person who's had like their net forward neck for 30 years, 35 years, and you're going to correct that posture. Physiologically, that's tough for me to I think it might be done, but you're going to have to correct lifestyle. If you're not correcting lifestyle, I'm not sure anything we do in the office works without making the corrections, getting rid of the negative factors and the offending factors.
We need to quote Andy on that, because that's like such a big thing. Because people come into the office thinking, crack and go, we're good, you know.
Actually, you know, it's funny, you know, Spencer, it's funny you say that. I won't take care of a patient who won't exercise. I refer them out.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. I just say, listen, this would just be temporary. If you want, you know, there are some other doctors who will work you on this. But that means if I get a 70-year-old patient, they have to deadlift, all right? Yeah. If you're living in Minnesota, all right, and you want to live on your own, you have to be able to lift a 40-pound bag of salt for your water conditioner, all right? So now I'm not having 70-year-old grandmas lift from the floor. Don't get me wrong. But we start with dumbbells, you know, dumbbells on a platform or something like that. Teach them the hip hinge and get them to lift. I think it's the most overlooked aspect of fitness that we have is the strength aspect, especially as we get older. We take it for granted we're supposed to get weaker. Well, I think we get weaker because people stop lifting. And what happens if you keep lifting? I mean, we've seen some of those videos on some of these 70 and 80-year-olds who are lifting, like deadlifting 300, 350 pounds. That should be what we do. We should deadlift till we die. I mean, that's really what we should be doing. I want to make up a t-shirt. I found out someone already trademarked that. They already trademarked it. And it's a great trademark. It's a skeleton lifting a barbell, you know?
Ugh.
I love that.
I had a student come up to me that one of the other doctors said that as you get older, you shouldn't squat, you know, and do that as you get older. It's bad for you. And they said, when do you think is the proper time to stop lifting? And I said, I think the proper time is probably like 3 days after you die, because at that point, you're not getting enough protein intake to support your structure. So you should probably stop lifting at that point.
And I got to find that shirt and deadlift till you die. That is, the moment you said it, I go, there's got to be a shirt out there.
There already is. I waited too long on it.
Yeah. Hey, Andy, you know, being so oriented towards, you know, strength and conditioning and, you know, soft tissue work and biomechanics, you know what, for the listening audience that thinks that chiropractors are just back crackers, could you share why you feel that's not the total health approach?
Well, I don't think it's a total health approach because it doesn't take – we know what helps the most, which is lifestyle. We know that. I'm a big, the whole chiropractic, philosophy and stuff. If we go back to the initial, Palmer's, what did he say? He said, find it, fix it, get it out of there. He didn't say have him come back three times a week. Our basic concept is that the body heals itself. So if the body heals itself, why does it need us constantly? To me, that means the body's not healing itself. If it needs to see me once a month, unless there are other factors, unless there are previous injuries or, you may have the long haul truck driver who has no choice but to get in that truck and drive 72 hours. There's someone who probably needs more constant care, that type of thing. Or the professional athlete who's getting banged around by huge behemoths every Sunday. They'll probably need more constant care. But I think most of the people we see, it's really more about lifestyle. Eat right, exercise, make sure you get enough sleep, that type of thing. I think in that sense, we're more life coaches and we can help, because I think manual therapy does have a place and is really helpful. But, I don't think we need to see people all the time. And I don't think it's chiropractic. I think it depends on the profession. Every profession has its own thing. They have I just have a patient client who I've been working with. And he came in and said, I just want to talk to you about the goals. And we totally changed his goals. And he thanked me because he said he's worked with personal trainers before who have a certain way of doing it. And if you want to do something different, if it doesn't follow their method, they're against it. My son is a physical therapist. So I know in physical therapy, they have some of the same conflicts that we have, within the profession.
Andy, that is great. There are so many things to highlight about this segment of time that we've spent together. We're going to wrap it up, but I want to be able to, I would like you to share just one or two things that you think that some of our new practitioners should be aware of in this age of chiropractic health. Anything in particular?
I think the one thing is just to keep working at it. I mean, it's a hard profession. All the health professions are hard right now. In fact, people ask me, they talk about going to school. I tell them, do not go into the health profession unless you really want to. It's not something you dabble in. But if you have a passion for it, it's a great profession. I mean, I love chiropractic. It hasn't been easy at times, but I love it. And so I would say just keep at it and keep learning. It does not stop. Keep learning. I would say that's the biggest thing I can give them. If you could, cash practice. I mean, the way things are, cash practice obviously is the best way to go. So that would be my 2 points. I think the only other point I'd like to make is I'd like to correct something from one of your previous podcasts where you had Harad on and you were talking about my love of fried chicken. And yeah, I listened to your podcast. I think I'm one of the 12 who listen. All right. So. Now, I love fried chicken. Don't get me wrong. And especially with AIDS, we have like a little mini tradition going on. But I think most students and most people who know me, if you had to pick a food or beverage to associate me with, it would be whiskey. It would be scotch. Yeah. I'd like to think I have a little bit more expertise in that, and I'd like to be known.
So Andy, I have every Wednesday at my house, I have an axe and whiskey night where we throw axes and we bring high end whiskey and we taste whiskey.
Oh my God.
So when you want to come out,
I'll check flights. I'll tell you I won't say what town you're in case people are looking for you. But I'll check flights. I'll DM you and we'll check flights. I have a bottle of scotch that you actually can't get. Dr. Bob Nelson in Colorado. We've had this thing going on. He was in Scotland and bought a share of a cask. What it is there's a master who tells you when it's ready. He paid money for it. And when it's ready, you get like 10 bottles sent to you or something. You can't even get it. And as a gift, he sent me a bottle and it's like liquid gold. I mean, I'm just,
you bring that.
No, I won't. That's not for, that's not for sharing except for Bob.
All right. Fair enough.
All right. I'll bring some.
I'll send you some information about it. Okay. And I'll let you know. But we just did a tasting up at High West with their Midsummer Dram. And now I'm on their list and I get a call when they I get stage one, act one, and it's pretty amazing. Very but nice. Yeah, we'll talk off air on that one.
Okay.
On the concept of fried chicken and whiskey, what's the biggest misconceptions people have on health, and especially with the last 2 years, health is on everybody's mind right now. So I want to kind of leave everybody with something that they can take away, because if health isn't in one of your conversations nowadays, yeah, then there's something wrong with you. So what's the biggest misconception? How do we change that misconception and move people in a better positive direction?
If I had to say one thing, to me, the biggest misconception is that people cannot take responsibility for their own health. That's been number one. And two, I think there's also a misconception about weight. You know, there's a huge difference between obesity and being a little overweight. And, you know, you don't have to look like all these pictures. You know, first of all, the pictures in the magazines aren't real. The people they're showing aren't real. By the time they Photoshop them and do the lighting and everything, that's not what they look like anyway. So it's just about feeling healthy and being able to move. And what do you want to do? What are your activities of daily living? Match your health up to what you want to be able to do every day and how you want to age, you know, aging gracefully. That would be my biggest takeaway, is you can take responsibility for your own health.
I love it.
Oh, I love that. That's perfect, a great way to end, man.
I appreciate it, buddy. All right. Very good.
Oh, I had a ball, you guys. This was fun.
Oh, it was. It was really good. Thanks. Oh, there he is.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Kraken Backs Podcast. We hope you enjoyed, and make sure you follow our Instagram at Kraken Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.